Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey sports fans, Coach Nick here, and welcome to B-Ball Breakdown. Before we get to the interview with Steve Kerr, I wanted to point out that I have had him on the show a couple times before, and they're really awesome interviews because I get to ask him questions that nobody ever asks him. We get into discussions about X's and O's and strategy and communication and shooting, all great stuff that you rarely see other media members ask. So you definitely want to check those out, link in the description below. And on this one, we start out talking about Steph Curry's new documentary and him being underrated, but what it really turns into is a discussion about how Steve Kerr was underrated as a player. And you'll hear some really great insights into shooting, as well as the way they built their offense around Steph to unlock him into one of the greatest players we've ever seen play the game. So, without much further ado, here is the interview I did with Steve Kerr. Well, Coach, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and breaking some stuff down with us about Steph Curry and this documentary. And I thought we could kind of just jump right into it with, here's my question. The underrated notion of this was that Curry's scouting report was way off, you know, but coming out of college into the NBA. It just so happens that at that time, you were probably busy reading a lot of scouting reports. Do you remember what that was like in your role as GM with the Suns?
Oh, yeah. We watched him carefully. I remember seeing him for the first time at UCLA. Davidson played against UCLA, actually in Anaheim at the John Wooden Classic. And he reminded us a lot of Steve Nash. And so we weren't as concerned about his size as a lot of the scouts were. I don't think anybody could have predicted, you know, what he eventually became. But and we thought he had a chance to be really good, and much like Nash, a guy who fit the modern game in terms of, you know, the skill set being able to, you know, check every box.
Well, that's fascinating because the modern game in theory didn't quite take hold until, you know, 2010 2011. This is now 2007 2008. But that said, I suppose we did have a model with Steve Nash, which you were busy watching up close and personal. So none of those things about being like too slow, being too small, getting pushed around, that didn't resonate with you guys as you were evaluating.
Well, I mean, it was a concern, but you know, not a big enough concern to not draft him. We tried to trade up to draft him, and we weren't able to. But yeah, I mean, he was so much like Nash, and I think because we had watched, you know, really Mike D'Antoni come in and change the way the NBA was played, that the Suns were kind of at the forefront of that, so it was maybe a little easier to see Steph stepping into a role where he could be a, you know, shot creator, shot maker, like Nash, because, you know, neither guy blew you away with the speed and bounce, but it was the balance and the coordination that was just, you know, so breathtaking.
You know, I'm kind of curious in checking how old Steve Nash was during Steph's rookie year. So he came in at 2009-10. Nash was 35. So imagine that, right? So imagine you bringing Curry into that, being mentored for a couple of years, and then going right into that. I suppose that was what you're thinking was, right, to sort of smoothly transition into the future.
Yeah, yeah, that was the idea. You know, we get a great mentoring situation with Nash. And I remember Steve told me, he said, yeah, Curry's my favorite player in the draft. I'd love to play with him. But it wasn't meant to be. And it's something I think about pretty often because I'm glad it wasn't. I'm glad it wasn't meant to be, because I never would have coached him here in Golden State.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because the notion of underrated and Steph Curry at this point doesn't really work, because obviously he's rated where he should be, I'd imagine, as one of the greats. But it did strike me when I was kind of preparing this and knowing I was going to talk to you that the real underrated with all caps would probably be the Steve Kerr story, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that would work in my story too. That title would work for sure.
So I just want to explore that because I've always been fascinated by players that came out of your era really good. You know, and by the way, one of the reasons is that we now know how to teach like shooting, for instance, a lot better than we did when you were growing up, when I was growing up. So I'm always amazed at the guys that actually did overcome what I would perceive as suboptimal teaching of shooting. So I was kind of curious, do you have any insight into, you know, 13-year-old Steve Kerr, 14-year-old Steve Kerr, as you got to develop that skill, what clicked so much better than most other people you were playing with?
Well, I had great coaching. You know, I used to go to John Wooden basketball camp when I was a kid. And then as I got older, I was lucky to work with Chip England, who went to my high school. He was 4 years ahead of me and now considered one of the great shooting coaches of all time. He actually coached me when I was 14, 15 years old. And so I had really good coaching. My high school coach, Jerry Marvin at Palisades High, was a legendary coach in the L.A. area. So I was really lucky to have great coaching and to learn, you know, some pretty basic mechanics as a young kid and then work on them from there.
So you feel like the basic mechanics that we all learned at some point, somehow you solved that better than most. I always feel like somebody would have said, I realized that when I finally started lifting my arms up before I started straightening my legs, something like that. But it seems to me that especially the good shooters don't always have that detail. It just sort of happens over hard work. Do you have any insight into that? Was there any little thing there that you noticed that you were doing other people weren't?
No, I think it was, I learned to shoot over a long period of time. I had really good hand-eye coordination as a kid. So, as soon as I could pick up a ball, I could make the ball go through the hoop. But as I got older, like all kids, I had to get the left hand off of the ball as much as I could. And, when I finally got strong enough to shoot one-handed, I had to work at that, but I was still learning about the shot even late in my NBA career and learning little tweaks, little thoughts and ideas that may have, just helped me during a season, maybe helped me get out of a slump. I just think it's like anything, it's a constant work in progress, and you're always learning, you're always getting better.
It's funny. I reference you and like Danny Ainge and a couple of guys from that era who come off a lot of pin downs. And a lot of times, how do you know that you're open coming around that pin down? I think I might have figured it out going frame by frame now that we have, YouTube and we can go look at these games again. But did you have a little secret to that? Because obviously the guy's trailing, for instance, and you have to know if you're open. Did you remember like how that worked for you, how you knew you could get up and just catch and shoot versus maybe having to continue to curl and dribble?
No, it was a really tough thing to do because the athletes in the NBA are just so good. It's one of the reasons why I was much better going to my right shooting than going to my left, unlike a lot of right-handed shooters, because going to my right allowed me to just get a half step further away from the defender. So one dribble right, I could create a tiny bit of separation. Now the shot blocker has to reach all the way across my body. Whereas if I'm going left, the shot blocker is right there on the ball. So I grew much more comfortable going to my right or even, curling off of a pin down, as I came to the pass, into shooting, with the ball in that right side pocket.
Because, I can almost picture it. I can see Ainge doing it. I think I can see you doing it in my brain. If you're going to your left, and by the way, to me, because you're going to your left, you're already more aligned to the basket with your right arm and right wrist. So it's almost like that's more natural. But my memory, I see coming off of a hop, which is another big one we can maybe discuss for a second. As you're in the air and the ball's coming in your hands, I feel like there's a glance down slightly where then out of the peripheral vision, you can then see where the guy is before you land into the shot or not. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, I probably figured that out instinctively. I never really, thought of it in those terms. But I think for me, like most players, it was a matter of learning the speed of the game and figuring out what I could and couldn't do. And that's the experience that, the value of experience as you go and you get better you just figure out where your shots are going to come from and how to get those shots off.
Well, okay, let's talk about getting shots off because, you know, there's a different era between in Steph's career between when coaches switched and you took over. So, and you've talked about this before, but I thought we could get into a little bit of discussion about the unlocking of Steph Curry. Although, ironically, I believe the first year you coached him, he averaged less per game slightly than the year before and then exploded the next year after that, which is probably part of the process of what you were doing, building your offense. So can you give us a little more insight into that and how you sort of built that and put it together from scratch?
Well, first of all, Steph was an all-star before I got here. So, he was one of the main reasons I wanted this job. He was such a brilliant player that I and a brilliant human being that I knew if I could connect with him, I'd have a much greater chance for success. All we tried to do, you know, when I got here my first year, our staff just wanted to get a little more movement. Steph was so good off the ball in college. And then he was getting really good on the ball his first few years in the NBA. And so that combination is so rare. Very few players, if any, have had that combination of being lethal both on and off the dribble. Mark Price comes to mind, maybe Ray Allen a little bit, not to the extent that Steph is, but usually guys are either good off the dribble or off the catch, but not both. So we also had a lot of great passers on our team, especially our big guys. So we just felt like moving Steph off the ball would open up the game with some of our passing with guys like Bogut, David Lee, Draymond. And so it was really a fun way to play.
Okay. And so and you sat down. I mean, you know, you had been a GM. You had played for Pop. You played for Phil Jackson on the triangle and other various offenses. So, you know, specifically some of the routes, some of the ways you decided to put it together, like how did that, you know, is there a way to encapsulate that process and explain that and how it all came together so quickly?
Yeah, I mean, I think the offense really was a hybrid of the triangle from Phil Jackson and Tex Winter. And the San Antonio weak and strong motion stuff. And so we had, you know, some of our sets were straight out of the San Antonio system. You know, our weak roll where Steph hits ahead, cuts through, and it's swing, and we pin down onto the screener down on the block. That was Tony Parker for years in San Antonio, and it just seemed like an obvious set. The biggest thing from the triangle were the low post splits. You know, we ran that in Chicago, and I always thought it was so hard to guard, and it was a great way to get open shots for shooters, catching the ball at an angle where they can already see the hoop. So they don't have to get these pin downs where they're running away from the hoop. You know, if you throw the ball to the low post and you get a split, if the defense makes a mistake, it's not only an open shot, but you're staring right at the rim, which I think makes it a much easier shot.
And I think the statistics will also bear that out. When the passes come from the basket area out, it's a higher percentage than other ones. And I always had a problem with floppy sets, which we don't see a lot of anymore because you're having to go so fast away from the basket and then somehow catch, get yourself in line, get that shot off the momentum. Now, you did probably more floppies than anybody in that era. In a way that had to be a thing that you needed to master, right? Coming off of going at a 45 degree away from the basket and then somehow turn and shoot it.
Yeah. I mean, we ran, some floppy in the triangle. That was one of our sets that Phil would actually run for, for those of us who were shooters on the team, you know, just a pin down. And if it's not there, You flow right back into the triangle, hit the post, set the split cut, you know, make the third cutter screen. I mean, all those things were so instinctive in that offense, which was one of the reasons it was such a fun offense to play in. But a lot of teams were running floppy back then. Pat Riley's teams all ran it. I think of John Starks flying off screens. Reggie Miller was the best of the whole era, flying off those multiple screens and being able to shoot you know, when his momentum was carrying him away from the hoop. Those are difficult shots, but yeah, Steph makes those with ease. JJ Redick, Klay Thompson, those are the guys I think of.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mm-hmm. And so, interestingly enough, about the low post splits that you're talking about is, when you watch the Bulls do it, when you were there, they didn't. You guys didn't often run that. You would have the corner and the wing cut through at the mm-hmm. same time, and then do your, you know, set a screen on the weak side forward and come across. So sometimes you would. I think I've even been able to find a couple times when I would go through the old footage of that split cut that you guys run now. So I'm kind of curious. So how did you? Because if you watch Texas teams from the Kansas State in the '60s, that was the base way they did it. The way you do it now. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of curious, how did you, I mean, that seemed to be a little bit of a departure from what the normal triangle was when you started running it. How did that come about?
Well, really, we just wanted to run it organically so that when the ball went into the post from the wing, it was just an automatic split between the guy on the wing and the guy at the top of the key. Usually we did not have the corner, the strong side corner filled. It was usually more of a five out or a four out setting with one guy posted and you run right into the splits. So it just sort of happened organically. But we, you know, as our guys got more and more comfortable with it, then we started calling sets out of it. And actually, you know, we eventually gave it a name and started running different things out of it. But the whole idea at first was, any of our big guys, you know, run down to the block, get the ball, and we're going to get Steph Curry and Klay Thompson in a split, and that's going to put a lot of stress on the defense.
Absolutely. And then what I like about it now is that I have to imagine, out of necessity, you've developed some really clever ways of disguising this until all of a sudden there's a split. It has to be because the defense has just simply got better at guarding the initial split and that basic action, right?
Yeah, and so many teams started switching that, you know, I think the whole league started to run gaggles where you get three guys in a row without the ball. And, you know, switching when there's three people involved off the ball is much more difficult than with two. And so I think Brad Stevens started running kind of weak side gaggles. Eric Spoelstra runs them beautifully in Miami. So we started adding that where, you know, now all of a sudden you're splitting, but you're getting a third guy curling out of those splits. And the ball sometimes will be up at the top of the key or at the wing. So you're doing it at different angles. And I think that's one way the NBA has really evolved over the last 5-6 years. Instead of, you know, all high pick and rolls with the floor space, you're getting more and more teams kind of adding this kind of movement, splits and gaggles, trying to confuse the switching defenses because they're tough to attack one-on-one.
Well, you know, what I noticed having studied so much footage and, you know, since, you know, 2010, when I started this whole thing, was that, you know, you hold the fist up, you call it, you know, pick and roll right at the beginning, and the defense, that's how they're used to practicing that. They're in the best position they can possibly be in if you do it from the start. What I feel like the Spurs sort of did influenced us in the 20 in their run was that they needed some side to side movement before the pick and roll. And I'm wondering if that is something that, I mean, you are close with Pop and this is what you're developing as well. It seems to me that this would be something you would probably tell every coach if they're designing their offense, to get some sort of movement before you then set the ball screen. Is that fair enough to say?
For sure. And that's what some of the weak and strong actions in San Antonio allowed Pop to do. So we've copied some of that stuff. I think the challenge now, you got so many teams who are playing four guys who are 6'7" and can switch everything. You really can't just do stuff from a stagnant basis and run a pick and roll and expect to gain much of an advantage unless your guy has otherworldly talent and can just blow by everyone. So I think that's where the creativity comes into play. And that's where, you know, as I said, I think there's a lot of coaches who are really clever with that. Rick Carlisle comes to mind. You know, he runs a lot of good stuff where there's some deception and movement. You're just trying to get the defense to react one way and just get them a half step behind when the pick and roll is actually established.
I'm kind of curious, you know, most NBA players are so skilled, they can go either direction, but do you ever find yourself sort of designing sets knowing you want to get this player going to his strong side, for instance, versus the other way? Does that ever come up?
Yeah. And a lot of times I'll call a play in the huddle and I'll just, you know, maybe Jordan Poole last year, Steph occasionally, they'll just say, hey, let's run it on the other side so I can go that way. I'll say, okay, well, we'll just flip it. And then I learned, you know, next time I call that play, I remember to run it on that side of the floor. But I would say most players have a tendency and a preference, you know, going one way or the other. And you definitely try to design stuff to players' preferred sides.
Well, you know, watching the Steph documentary, what I'm doing, going frame by frame, I can kind of look at it on my computer screen. And I'm always examining the mechanics and all the things that Steph is doing. The one thing that, you know, I make a big deal about is how the eyes follow the ball after the release. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this before. We have freeze frames with you doing this before the ball's out of your hand even. And I know you've mentioned this before where I believe you had coaches in your past who tried to stop you from doing that. Is that right?
Yeah. In fact, Chip England tried to get me to switch. And as I said, he's, you know, he's one of the great teachers of all time. To me, I think it's, you don't really teach it. I think a player, when he starts shooting, naturally does one or the other based on what his brain is telling him to do. And I would feel strange telling someone to, you know, to shift because it was so awkward for me when I tried to do it. But, you know, having studied players, you know, once I learned that, oh, wait, some people watch the ball, some people look at the rim, I started paying closer attention. And there's guys who do both, you know, like some of the great shooters of all time were ball watchers, you know, Reggie Miller, Larry Bird, Steph, Clay. But there's also been phenomenal shooters, Eddie Johnson, who just stared at the rim the entire time. There's great shooters on both sides. It's just, I think it's however your brain operates, you just let the person go.
I mean, I will say the list of the great shooters that do foul the ball is much longer than the don't. So, you know, Redick and KD are the two guys right now I could think of who really are laser focused on the rim the whole way. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's interesting is that, and you, I think you can back me up on this, it's a different shot when you do one or the other and you try doing the other way, right? Is that the other way to you?
When I tried to just look at the rim and I shot the ball, I felt like I had no idea where the ball was going. I felt naked. It was a bizarre feeling. And so I didn't experiment with that for more than about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Now, and by the way, the argument is, what does it matter? It's out of your hand for the most part. So how, but I think that must be the testament to how much the psychological aspect of shooting influences the ball, right? I mean, that sort of tells you right there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's in every player's mind, you know, how he sees the ball, how he sees the hoop, how he's comfortable. So I think I would never change anybody from one direction to the other. You know, like you said, Kevin Durant is a rim watcher. JJ Redick, these guys are, you know, two of the greatest shooters of all time. So I think Mark Price, if I remember correctly, was also a rim watcher. I'd have to check that, but there's definitely a psychological component to shooting, and you just want the player to have as much confidence as possible.
Yes, that's a really good point. And the confidence thing, I tend to kind of get a little bit uneasy, because I don't know what that means per se. To me, what confidence means is rhythm. And what rhythm to me is very, because I like the concrete, very specific stuff. So to me, rhythm is, when are you lifting your arms in conjunction with when are your knees straightening, which is a concept that I don't think you probably never, when you were growing up and even in the high school, no one had ever discussed that concept with you while you were shooting, right?
Yeah, I remember my high school coach brought it up to me. That was the first time anybody ever said anything to me. But now I've really grown to look at that closely when I see a shooter. I've even asked you a couple times, hey, can you evaluate one of our guys and tell me what you see? And you've pointed out, you know, maybe the ball going up and the body going down. You know, as a player rises up here, his knees are going down to bend. Two things going in opposite direction. It's almost impossible to tie that back together. And so I know you're a big proponent of rhythm. I think it's a huge part of being a great shooter. And it's one of the reasons Steph Curry is the greatest of all time, because he is constantly in rhythm.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, let's talk about really quickly about the hop, because you were a hop shooter. Mm-hmm. And again, Craig Hodges has a great story. You guys didn't line up for the Bulls together, but you might have even come across his path. And he talked about a great story of him doing the drills, I think, for the Bulls and killing everybody, getting more shots off and work quicker than anybody else. And the coaches are looking at him like they don't know what, why. And he's like, I'm hopping and these guys are trying to 1-2 it and they can't get it off in time. I don't remember. I actually, when I was growing up, I had a hop coming off the baseline, you know, like almost like a floppy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And never shot it anywhere else. And even though I loved it, it was really good for me. And I think part of the reason why is because no one ever taught it or even talked about it. So how did you develop that? Was that high school? Was that college? Was that later?
That was college. Yeah. I had an assistant coach at Arizona named Scott Thompson who taught me the hop. And I just started really shooting, you know, hundreds of shots a day, and I'd shoot 10 at a spot, and you know, and Coach Thompson would rebound for me, he'd throw it right back, and I would, it just was so natural to hop into a shot 10 times in a row as you're getting the rhythm of the rebound back and forth. And I think I just shot so many shots practicing that way that the hop just became really natural for me. And that's why, you know, I was much more of a spot up shooter than anything, is that, you know, that hop, as that pass is coming, if you can be, you know, have your momentum going towards the ball, towards the hoop, that hop just builds that rhythm and makes the shot much easier.
Well, you know, I just made this epiphany, having been a hop coach for a long time and thought I knew everything about it. You know, the notion of, we talk about rhythm, you know, when you lift your feet off the ground as you're right before you catch it, as the feet are touching the ground, your knees are already beginning that straightening into that spring off of the ground, right?
Right.
When you watch a 1-2, oftentimes when they plant the two, mm-hmm. there's still some more flexing down into that bend, right? And you're, so mm-hmm. you're not, you can't quite mimic that hop, that springiness. All of that said, I've been able to help some 1-2s get that happening a little bit more closer to a hop. So I guess the point being is that, yes, the more closer we can get to a hop, I think the more ideal our shot ends up being. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the shot when Stockton comes off of you and Michael hits you on the top of the key, that's a hop into the game winner, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. And to me, it's just easier. But the 1-2 is the one you have to do off the pin down. You know, you really can't do a hop off of a pin down, because you'd be catching the ball facing the opposite direction. So you have to turn your body and then 1-2. And I think that's a much more difficult shot, but that's where you see the separation from, you know, the high school great shooters to college, to the pros. And when you look at guys now, you know, Jamal Murray and Steph and you know, you mentioned Redick, guys who are, you know, Chris Middleton curling off a pin down and getting into the paint, 1-2 rising up, shooting over the top. It's just lethal.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen guys being able to groove in the hop, and like, it's a pirouette almost, right? To like land mm-hmm. and get the alignment as you're hopping. Some guy, you can do it, but I hear you, the inside pivot foot ends up helping you get that turn better under balance. But let's finish this up, I thought, with a little bit of sort of coaching communication philosophy, because that keeps coming up, and I feel like we're in this crossroads where you have a lot of coaches who are, let's just say, you know, older than you, right? And then there are other coaches who are, you know, like your age and younger. There seems to be a crossroads here where certain coaches coach a certain way, and I might use the terms like anger and disgust could be a real motivational tool they use or communication tool. It feels like perhaps we're moving away from that as we understand, you know, the chemistry of the brain. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if you had some insights into that. I mean, people might just sort of scoff and say, well, you're in the NBA and those are men, they're professionals, they're making all this money. You're not going to be yelling and screaming. But I think it's safe to say you probably have seen your share of that kind of communication at the NBA level too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest area where coaching has changed is the nature of what is said. There's still plenty of coaches, myself included, who will snap occasionally and, you know, yell and scream. I think it's more effective the less often you do it. But I think you have to have that in your bag, because the players need to know that you're in charge and that you're paying attention. In the old days, though, coaches could denigrate you and say things that were personally offensive. And it seems so crazy now, but when I look back at, you know, my career growing up, other coaches or coaches, you know, coaches who coached me, like it wasn't that uncommon to have someone really say something offensive, and you were just supposed to take it. And so I think we've come a long way, and I think every coach now in the NBA knows that if you want to get fired, that's a great way to do it. You know, be personally offensive to your players. So I've been so blessed to play for Pop and Phil Jackson and Lute Olson and Lenny Wilkins, all these Hall of Famers. And there's always this respect level that comes from great coaches, a communication, a respect that allows that coach to also, you know, get a little pissed off and lose his mind and yell. As long as you know the coach cares about you, and I think it's, you know, you'll let him yell at you. That's kind of my philosophy.
Sure. And I do want to point out that there is a difference between like passion and anger, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So passion is great. I mean, yeah, we see you, you'll throw the clipboard sometimes and stuff like that. Right. And I think that you're right, that there are moments for that as well. I don't want you to have to break any news, because I was going to say, hey, give me what's an example of some of this insulting thing you're talking about. But you don't happen to have an anecdote like that from a long time ago, do you?
No.
Okay.
No. I'd rather not share that stuff. But I think just in general, I think there's a much better awareness that that the respect level has to be there. But more importantly, that the best way to reach someone is to speak to them in a human way, in a connective way. It's clearly been proven in studies that human beings will respond better when they're addressed in a respectful manner. But hopefully, you know, if you have a good season and a team that responds well to coaching, it all becomes more of a collaboration at the NBA level. And that's what I've really enjoyed, is collaborating with our players here and trying to figure out whatever equation is in front of us.
For sure. And I would love for that statement to even emanate down to college and high school. I mean, that collaboration can still happen. I can remember when I was coaching high school as a head coach, you know, I've heard coaches who will after every practice, they will invite feedback from the players. How did I do? How did I coach today? And I'm shuddering to think of my rookie, when I was a first year head coach at the high school level, I wouldn't have wanted that. I don't want to hear what right. they have to say about me. But man, if I were to do it again, I can tell you right now, I would have those questionnaires. I would want that feedback, and I would want them to be able to express themselves in that same way. I think it's really important. I mean, I suppose you obviously do you get feedback from your NBA guys on your coaching?
Yeah. I think we have a pretty collaborative process. And so, I've had players, our leaders, you'd never get this from a young player, but, you know, our leaders have told me in the past, hey, you know, you may have crossed the line on this one, or, you know, okay, you know, but it's a collaborative relationship built on years of trust. And, you know, since we all know that we're all going to make mistakes, we're all human, I think it makes it easier just to once you build that chemistry that allows for this to happen, it's much easier to just speak freely and understand that, you know, nobody is right all the time. Nobody's wrong all the time. It's really a process to try to find the best possible solution and then try it. And you have to have the awareness that it may not work because this is not a math experiment, you know, or a math equation. This is or a science experiment. This is just, it's basketball. It's more art than science.
Sure. Warriors fans are now racking their brains trying to figure out who you're talking about and what that situation was. But we'll leave it to their imagination.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
The last thing I'll leave this with is, I think in this idea of how we want to communicate, how we want to coach and what it means and how we hit the studies, do you think that there's a thing about the modern era where three-point shooting is so important, right? And where if you're going to get outscored by three or four or five threes a game in that game, you're probably going to lose. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that keeping your players in a certain frame of mind in order to be able to be ready to shoot and be successful shooting from 25 feet or farther is imperative in this game. And I think that goes for every level now. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we constantly are pushing for our players to shoot threes. Maybe too much so last year. We had games where we were just launching that I thought it got a little out of hand. And so you want to find some balance. But there's no doubt. You just look at the numbers. And if you make more threes than your opponent in the NBA these days, I think it's like an 80%. You probably know the number better than I do. But it's really hard to win games when you don't make more threes than your opponent. So it's obviously been something we've, built our team on for good reason with Steph and Clay and Kevin Durant here and Jordan Poole and a lot of guys who were great shooters. So we'll keep doing that. But the rest of the league's doing it too. And there's a lot of great shooters out there.
And you had that kind of focus on, okay, we got to keep these guys calm. We got to keep these guys in the moment. We don't want to add to any agita with our own coaching, you know, stuff. Like, is that a focus for you guys in terms of maybe getting a little bit of an edge?
Yeah. You don't want the guys feeling, you know, like pressure and thinking about every shot, you know, because there's a lot at stake. And I know from my own playing experience, it was just so much easier to play when I was loose and free, and that's the atmosphere we try to provide for our guys.
Well, I've seen some practices, and I certainly have. I recognize that atmosphere you're describing is there and is created. Mm-hmm. It's been amazing. And in fact, what's more amazing, having been to practices a lot of other teams, is how quickly you will put in the things you're talking about offensively. They can run it really easily, very within a few times, and then more importantly, that night run it
right
well, which is a testament to, I think, everything that you've built. So. Coach, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate it. This has been really enlightening.
Coach Nick, always a pleasure. Great to see you.
Well, I'll sign off like I always do if you can join me. And don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, we're not a channel, we're a conversation. You in? Are you in, Coach?
I'm in.